Today's Taisho will be on Case 28 in the Mumon Kan. Case 28 is entitled Ryutan Blows Out the Candle. Toku-san asked Ryutan about Zen far into the night. At last, Ryutan said, "The night is late. Why don't you retire?" Toku-san made his bows and lifted the blinds to withdraw, but he was met by darkness. Turning back to Ryutan, he said, "It's dark outside." Ryutan lit a paper candle and handed it to him. Toku-san was about to take it when Ryutan blew it out. At this, all of a sudden, Toku-san went through a deep experience and made bows. Ryutan said, "What sort of realization do you have?" "From now on," said Toku-san, "I will not doubt the words of an old Osho who is renowned everywhere under the sun." Next day, Ryutan ascended the rostrum and said, "I see a fellow among you. His fangs are like the sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. Strike him with a stick and he won't even turn his head to look at you. Somewhere or other, he will climb the highest peaks and establish our way there." Toku-san brought his notes on the Diamond Sutra to the front hall, pointed to them with a torch, and said, "Even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, it is like placing a hair in vast space. Even though you have learned all the secrets of the world, it is like a drop of water dripping on the great ocean." And then he burned all his notes. Making vows, he took leave of his teacher. Mumon's comment. Before Toku-san crossed the barrier from his native place, his mind burned and his mouth uttered bitterness. He went southward, intending to stamp out the doctrine of special transmission outside the sutras. When he reached the road to Reishu, he asked an old woman to let him have lunch to refresh the mind. "Your worship, what sort of literature do you carry in your pack?" the old woman asked. "Commentaries on the Diamond Sutra," replied Toku-san. The old woman said, "I hear it said in that sutra, the past mind cannot be held, the present mind cannot be held, the future mind cannot be held. Now I would like to ask you, what mind are you going to have refreshed?" At this question, Toku-san was dumbfounded. However, he did not remain inert under her words, but asked, "Do you know of any good teacher around here?" The old woman said, "5 miles from here you will find Ryutan Osho, priest Ryutan." Coming to Ryutan, Toku-san got the worst of it. His former words were inconsistent with his later ones. As for Ryutan, he seems to have lost all sense of shame in his compassion towards his son. Finding a little bit of live ember in the other enough to start a fire, he hurriedly poured on muddy water to annihilate everything at once. A little cool reflection tells us it was all a farce. Mumon's verse, "Hearing the name cannot surpass the face, seeing the face cannot surpass the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes." So, thank you so much for coming to practice today. We have, I don't know when you woke up, but around 4:30 maybe, 4 o'clock, there was a beautiful, beautiful thunderstorm where I live. It was just absolutely amazing. And beautiful, wonderful way to start the day. And then to come here, really marvelous. You know, this is one of the most famous stories in Zen. It's about a Tang Dynasty scholar who was an expert on the Diamond Sutra. In this in this koan, he's called Tokusan. But his original ordination name, we don't know. But he became famous as a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and he was so famous that he was known as Diamond Shu, because he would lecture on the Diamond Sutra, and his lectures were so brilliant and compelling that everybody was in awe of his great intelligence. And then one day, while he was teaching, he gave a lecture, and then during the question and answer period, somebody stuck up his hand and said, "You say it's essential to know the Diamond Sutra in order to wake up. But there is a sect of Buddhism called the Zen sect, the Chan sect. And they teach that it's not necessary to read the sutras, that you can achieve enlightenment on the cushion." And Diamond Shu was very upset by this, and he decided that this was a real heresy that had to be confronted. And he found out where the Zen sect was centered. There was at one time Zen was located in a small part of China before it spread out across China. And he decided to go there and confront the heretics. And the koan says that, you know, as he was traveling with he had a basket containing the Diamond Sutra and other key sutras, probably some of his commentaries, just this big basket of knowledge. And as he was heading towards this region where Zen had taken root, he was traveling on foot, and he eventually got very tired. So he decided to stop at an inn and refresh himself with a snack and a drink. And in Chinese, there's a phrase, tian xin. And tian xin is literally like refreshment or like a snack. But it's not literally. It means refreshment or snack. But it literally means like mind refreshment or mind renewal, right? So he went to this inn, and there was an old waitress there, and he probably didn't pay any attention to her. He probably didn't think she was an important person in any way, and he said, "Please bring me some tian xin, some mind refreshment." And this is a very famous story, because it turns out that this waitress, who wasn't a monk, wasn't a nun, didn't have any credentials, asks him a question that shows deep, really penetrating insight. She says, "You know, you're asking for mind refreshment, but what mind do you want to refresh?" And it's like, huh? You know, he was. Suddenly this question came out of nowhere, and it really reached into his heart. Yes. "What mind do you wish to refresh?" And it was like, what? And she said, "Because, you know, past mind is an illusion, present mind is an illusion, and future mind is an illusion." And this is a teaching right out of the Diamond Sutra. So, you know, when he heard this, it was astonishing to him. And he wondered who is this old woman in front of me who has such deep insight. But they say he sort of rocked back on his heels, but, you know, basically he's a very good person. right? He's a decent, he's a very good person, and he recognizes her insight. And he's humbled by her insight. By she has, in some ways, a superior understanding to him somehow. And he says, "Is there a good, is there a Zen teacher around here? How do you know all this? You know, how do you have this deep insight?" And she says, "There is a teacher. His name is Ryutan, and he lives about 5 miles from here." So Tokusan goes to this Zen temple, and he encounters Master Ryutan, who's this old man running this temple. And he becomes Ryutan's student. This is the Zen sect that he came to challenge. But his encounter with the old woman really changed his mind. And he's there doing training with Ryutan. And he takes the Dharma name in that temple, Tokusan. So this story begins one night when they're doing Dokusan. Tokusan is a scholar, and he likes to talk. He likes ideas. And so, when he goes into Dokusan, he's constantly responding from this intellectual place. You know, he might go into the Dokusan room and say, how can nothingness exist? Because if nothingness exists, it must be something. And if it's something, it can't be nothing. And if we're something, how can we experience nothingness, you know? And Tokusan just patiently lets him sort of ramble on and then ends the interview, you know. So, well, go back to the cushion, you know. It'll all be there on the cushion if you just go back to the cushion. And so on one of these occasions, you know, Tokusan has been doing this for years and years. He's been sitting on the cushion, and he's been thinking and thinking and sitting on the cushion. But, you know, all this time he's been doing a lot of zazen. He's been doing a lot of sitting on the cushion. And he goes in one night and gives the usual sort of, they have the usual sort of intellectual exchange. But on this occasion, Tokusan talks so long that Ryutan didn't have watches in those days, but Ryutan realizes, oh my gosh, he's gone through 2 sticks of incense. It must really be late, you know. And he says, you know, it's late. Maybe you should leave now, you know, and go to bed, you know. Tokusan is about to leave, but the door to the Tokusan room is like one of those bamboo blinds that rolls up and rolls down. And he rolls it up, and he sees it's pitch dark out there. And he turns to the teacher, and he says, it's dark out there. I don't know how to get back to the monks' quarters. And so Ryutan, they have paper candles, not wax candles, because wax candles were hard to find and expensive. So they have paper candles. And he lights a paper candle, which is like a candle. It's very tightly packed, sheet of paper that's rolled like a candle. He lights it Ryutan lights it and hands it to Tokusan. But as soon as Tokusan takes it, Ryutan blows out the candle, and Ryutan has a kensho, an awakening experience. See? And actually, it's his dai kensho experience, a great awakening experience. So I'll stop. There's more to the story, but I'll stop there. You know, somebody like Diamond Shu, I myself, you know, I work in a university, and I'm surrounded by people who spend their whole lives acquiring knowledge. And, you know, these people have really often noble intentions. They're really noble intentions. They're really good people. You know, so, a friend of mine is a scholar of the Byzantine Empire. And I saw him the other day, and And I said, "How's it going?" And he says, "Oh, you know, I have they're canceling my class on the Byzantine emperors. There's just not enough students interested." And he said, "Our enrollments are really down, and I'm saddened by that." So he came up with a course that has a sexier title. It's called Medieval Feast and Famine. And it's packed, of course. You know, so that's going to solve that problem. Nobody wants to hear about the Byzantine emperors, but they do want to hear about feast and famine in the Middle Ages, and maybe Dumbledore will appear. And so on. So, you know, but he was depressed, you know, because this is his passion, you know. And he's been studying. He knows Greek. He knows Latin. He knows, you know, a classical Greek. He knows medieval Greek. And he can't get, you know, 15 students to show up for his class. You know, and so, you know, it's people who, and I have another friend who's a poetry person, you know, and in the United States today, if you go, there aren't many bookstores left, but if you go into a bookstore, there's usually a poetry section, but it's not very big, you know. It's usually a small section. And, you know, the number of people who read poetry is actually very small. Poetry books don't sell very well. You know, so if you were to sell 30,000 poetry books, you would be a rock star, you know, in the world of poetry. Now, you know, in commercial publishing, 30,000 books, they don't even let you in the front door, you know. So basically, you know, being a poet is kind of a lonely life in some ways, you know. So these people really, really do sacrifice a lot for knowledge. So, you know, I don't think that this is really criticizing the desire to learn and to study and to you know, acquire knowledge. I think that's a very noble thing to do, especially if your motivation is to help others, you know. But, you know, often knowledge isn't really pursued for that reason, you know. Often knowledge is pursued for other reasons. So, for example, you know, there are people here at Rutgers who are, you know, internationally famous scholars. And if you meet them, they're breathtakingly arrogant, you know. There are such people, you know, out there. And they will hardly, you know, I've encountered them all my life, you know, and they're very they sort of reek of condescension, you know. And when you talk to them, they're sort of looking down their nose at you. There are such people also, you know. So, you know, some people pursue knowledge because they are moved by a deep passion, and some people pursue knowledge because it's very tied in with their self-image, right, their ego. And those two things can sometimes even go together. But, you know, there are people who become very arrogant about knowledge. And when knowledge has this quality, you know, it's really tied in with the desire to control your circumstances, this desire for control, you know. And so this desire, knowledge can be linked to this desire to control, to be powerful, to be special, see. And it's not just a quest for knowledge, you know. There are many different ways of acquiring power, you know, and acquiring knowledge is one of them, you know. Acquiring money is another way. But I think what's wrong with Tokusan is that he's used his knowledge to become a very special person, a person who's maybe, you could say, like, superior to others. He sees himself as that, in that way, see. You know, many people, even if you practice Zen, you know, you can practice Zen in that spirit too, not just book learning, but, you know, many people, I think, get into Zen, or some people get into Buddhism, let me say, because, you know, in the modern world, we feel vulnerable and powerless, you know? I think that's quite common. You know, I was listening yesterday to a radio program at WNYC with Brian Lehrer. I don't know if you ever listened to it, but he had a call-in show, and he was asking people to call and talk about how they're experiencing the Trump period, the first 100 days of Trump. And all these people called in and said, you know, one woman said, "I can't sleep." She said, you know, I can't watch the news anymore because it creates so much anxiety. And many of these people said they felt very powerless. You know, they felt really powerless to do something. You know, today, a number of our members there's a big demonstration, big march today, and a number of our members are out marching. And they're trying to overcome that sense of powerlessness, you know, in a good way, I think, by bonding with other people for a common purpose. But, you know, I think sometimes people get attracted to Zen, maybe even on an unconscious level, or Buddhism in general. You know, when they see somebody like the Dalai Lama, or they read about great enlightened sages of the past, you know, it's possible to imagine these people as like invulnerable. You know, so many times in my life, I have actually been asked if I can, believe it or not, can you read people's minds? I have actually asked people, can monks fly? Can monks fly? And those are fantasies of a power, like fantasies of power, of control over life. You know, so one way to think about Diamond Shoe, otherwise known as Tokusan, is that he's somebody who's motivated by this desire to control. To have power over things, you know. And in our world, you know, knowledge, you know, when I was in intermediate school, we had a little school emblem. Our school emblem was a little, it was like a design, and it said, "Knowledge is power. Knowledge is power." You know, I had no idea what knowledge was, and I had no idea what power was. But they were trying to send us a signal. They didn't say what kind of power knowledge was. The knowledge of the Byzantine emperors doesn't give you much power. But some forms of knowledge are very high, very powerful forms of knowledge, right? I mean, so, you know, here at Rutgers, we do a lot of research, biotech, which makes millions and millions of dollars. Now, that's power, right? That's some kind of power. Knowledge, the desire for, like, power, I think is what's going on with Tokusan. And it's understandable, right? Because, you know, people feel powerless. And sometimes people get involved in Buddhism because they imagine that if you just do enough meditation, you will become, like, invulnerable, like an invulnerable person, right? You have power. You know, there have been some. I definitely think that is an element of some people's experience of, you know, the Dalai Lama. You know, people do have fantasies about what he can achieve and so on. But this is quite common. You know, if you read many books in the Indian tradition, there are wonder-working, you know, even the Bhagavad Gita. If you ever read the Bhagavad Gita, you know, basically Arjuna is, you know, very, his wisdom makes him really powerful, really powerful. You know, it's interesting, by the way, that, in the Buddhist time, monks and nuns were not allowed to do miracles. Isn't that interesting? I find that fascinating. You know, in some religious traditions, the ability to perform miracles is a sign that your religious tradition is justified or valid. You know, so if you can basically transform water into wine or something like that, you're shown to be a special person. Yeah. And in some traditions, you know, like in the Middle East, there's this tradition of some people possess what's called baraka, and baraka is like special power that unique people have, and they also perform miracles, you know. But I think it's very interesting that in early Buddhism, the Buddha didn't say that miracles couldn't be performed. That is to say, he didn't say miracles were impossible. But what he said is, if you're a monk, you're one of my followers. If you're a monk or you're a nun, or you're a lay follower or lay man or woman who follows me, you're not allowed to do miracles. See, I think that's fascinating. And the Buddha said, you know, the real miracle is just, you know, basically breathing in and breathing out, drinking tea or drinking water, eating your rice. You know, that the real miracle is being here now. You know, think of how extraordinary it is to exist. You know, in Buddhism we say that it's very hard to be born as a human being, believe it or not. I mean, being born is probably pretty hard. We don't remember it, fortunately. But it's probably a pretty tough experience. You know, you go through a lot as you enter this world. But that's not really what Buddhism means or what the Buddha meant. You know, he said, you know, your human life is really precious. It's taken you, this is the Buddhist way of thinking, it's taken you countless lives of many different forms before you could be born as a human being. In one of the sutras it actually says that if you were a turtle swimming in the ocean, and the chances of being born a human among all the forms of birth in the universe are so small. Imagine you're a farmer and you live on the coast and you have a yoke for your oxen, you know, leather yoke, and you throw it in the water because it's used up. And it floats out into the Pacific Ocean. And in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, a turtle is coming up for air, and his head goes through the yoke, you know, like that you would put on in the neck of an ox. Well, the Buddha says it's like that. The chances that would happen are the chances of a human birth. You know, so being born just as a human is, from the Buddhist way of thinking, a great, like, miracle. Great improbability made real, you know. And the Buddha said, don't, even if you can perform miracles, if you can walk on water, that's great, but don't do it. Because you're misleading people. You know, Buddhism is not about acquiring power. It's not about becoming invulnerable. See, and this is, I think, widely, you know, people unconsciously, we feel so powerless, we unconsciously desire to become powerful people, to compensate, you know. But, you know, that the more we crave power over control, the more we are separate from everything around us, you know. Basically controlling things, being invulnerable, is not the goal of Zazen. You know, and we in the West, rather, I think, believe that it might be. We're not the only ones who think this way. As I said, you know, if you read the Indian classical Hindu literature, it's filled with these very powerful figures who are able to, like, draw the energy of the universe into their bodies and make things happen. But, you know, if you could do that, you would be separating yourself from everything around you. You know, the goal of meditation practice is not to become inviolable or indestructible, or, you know, it's to become one with the world, one with the world. It's to inhabit your life fully and to be connected with the larger life around you in ways that you really can't even imagine until you start walking down this road. So deep connectedness with the world around you. So the goal of Zen practice isn't to become invulnerable. It's to become connected. And those two things are opposites, actually. You know, so Tokusan is, you know, in some ways, maybe he's a little bit like my friend in the history department who teaches Byzantine history, but he's a little bit more like the kind of people who work for very well-funded think tanks, you know, in D.C., and write position papers and pull in these giant salaries, you know. And so, you know, he is maybe pursuing, following the path for the wrong reason, see. And so when he goes to, he hears about the Zen sect, the Zen tradition. You know, Zen basically says, you know, in you, in your body, in your human body, is everything you need to wake up. You know, the Zen people believe that the human body is like a machine for enlightenment, that it was like designed for enlightenment. And, you know, the way to do this is sitting down on the cushion, watching the breath, and entering deep samadhi, and working through our obstacles. You know, so at any rate, you know, Tokusan is somebody who's, I think, maybe pursuing power, not connection. And when he hears about the Zen sect that says, everybody has the capacity to wake up, what does that do to your power? See, if you've spent your life studying the sutras in order to become a special person, then if everybody can wake up without even having this knowledge, all your power is gone. You know, it's all for nothing, right? It's all for nothing. So it's very threatening to Diamond Shoe that people are being told, you know, there's no special power anywhere that's worth pursuing. That's all an illusion. You know, that's threatening to him. So he sets out on his journey and he goes to this restaurant and there's this waitress there, and he probably walks around most of the time thinking, I'm Diamond Shoe. You know, I know more than anybody. You know, I'm closer to the truth than anyone. And then this, you know, Zen tradition is filled with these women who are deeply enlightened. And they sneak in the picture and overturn people's assumptions. So anyway, she said, you know, he says, I'll have some tianxin, I'll have some mind refreshment. And she says, oh, really? You know, you're a monk. What mind were you thinking of refreshing? Because, you know, the sutra says, past mind doesn't exist, present mind doesn't exist, and future mind doesn't exist. And he's dumbfounded. You know, so he goes to study with Master Ryotan. And that's where the Taisho begins. That's where the koan, rather, begins. Now, you know, the thing that's so interesting about, one of the things that's so interesting about this is that, you know, Diamond Shoe, who becomes Tokusan in our story, is changing all the time, but he's the last to know it, you know? So when you're doing your Zen practice, if you're practicing with great regularity, if you're sitting often, you know, it's changing you, but you may not be aware because many of the things that are happening are operating on a subliminal or unconscious level. You know, so from day to day, you may not feel much different. You know, you may, but you may not. But believe me, if you're meditating regularly, if you're following the way of Zen, you're changing yourself profoundly over time. The way you process information is going to change. And, you know, it's like it's like Tokusan's scholarly, power-seeking, discriminating mind is going full blast all the time. But meanwhile, on a deeper level, he's undergoing a profound transformation. See, that his we say that thinking, that power-seeking, egocentric mind, we call in Zen the small mind, the small mind. So his small mind is pretty much unchanged right now, right? He goes in to see Ryotan, and he goes on and on and on and on. And Ryotan just says, well, you know, go back to the cushion, you know, don't worry, just keep sitting, it'll all become clear. And, you know, I have this feeling, Ryotan says that, and Tokusan walks out thinking, you know, he's a dope, you know, what does he know, that old man, right? But something keeps Ryotan, keeps Tokusan at the temple. So, you know, he keeps sitting, and his big mind is operating, is revving into high gear. He's activating the deeper parts of his awareness. Meanwhile, his small mind hasn't gotten the news. And this is often the case. You know, so when people are coming, when you come to Sesshin and you do koan practice, or when we do koan practice here, it's very often the case that, you know, people will come into Dokusan and say, oh, I'll say, what's happening on the cushion? And they'll say, oh, nothing, nothing. And I'll say, okay, well, tell me about nothing, right? And they'll say, well, this happened, I thought of this, and then this happened, and I noticed this. And it actually, sometimes it's the answer to the koan. And it's like the big mind is not allowing them to be receptive to what the small mind is not allowing them to be receptive to the message being sent by their big mind. So it's a little bit schizophrenic for a while. You know, part of Zen practice is learning to just push that small mind out of the way and be more receptive to the big mind, which is really quite intelligent. You know, so people in Sesshin sometimes come in and they say, well, nothing's happening. And I'll say, well, tell me what is happening. You know, and they'll say, well, nothing of importance. And then I'll say, oh, well, that's the answer to your koan. And probably they leave thinking, huh? But it doesn't matter, because that's just small mind intelligence, right? Something on a deeper level is stirring, there's this coming to life of the big mind. See, so this is what's happening to Tokusan. You know, his little mind hasn't gotten the message, but there's a coming to life of his big mind. See, and then he goes in to see old Ryotan, and they have this exchange, and Ryotan knows. See, he can see what's going on under the surface, and he blows out the candle, and Diamond Shoe, alias Tokusan, has a kensho, a great awakening experience. Now, you know, this is the way of Zen, right? And, you know, we all want to control life. We all want to be invulnerable or special, right? Special. You know, there are almost 9 billion people on the earth. You know, and one way to respond to that is to feel terrified. Like, I'm a grain of sand on this planet, you know? And you know, it's possible to respond to that by saying, I've got to find something that is going to make me special. I've got to find something that's going to make me special. You know, and maybe it's, you know, music, or maybe it's writing poetry, and there's nothing wrong with doing those things. But, you know, if the motive is to become special, it's an exercise in futility. You know, there are 8 billion people on the planet, you know. And, you know, there are a few people like Shakespeare who probably won't be forgotten for a long time. But pretty much everybody's going to be forgotten if we go on long enough. See, you know, if you get a PhD in English, you will read many authors who have. You'll go to the library and you'll pull off books from the shelf, and you'll open the back of the book. You know, in the old days when you checked out a book, they used to stamp it. There used to be a little card in the back. This is long before some of you were even born. But there used to be, in a library book, you would check the book out, and there was a card in the back, and they would stamp the card with the due date, see? And if you were late, you'd pay a fine. And a heavy fine was 50 cents or something. So anyway, if you go to the library, and you're a scholar of, say, Byzantine history, and you pull a book off the shelf, and you open it up, you look at that card, because the card is still in there. You blow the dust off. You look at the card, and you see it was last checked out in 1985, right? And the time before that was 62, right? And, you know, the guy who wrote the book in his time was really famous, right? But he's gone, right? So maybe instead of trying to be special or being invulnerable, you know, we can try this other path of becoming one with the world. See? Becoming one with. You know, that there's a way to be a poet, and there's another way to be a poet. One way to be a poet is be desperately trying to be special, right? Desperately. Another way to be a poet is to realize that you're giving a gift to people you don't know. You don't know them, but it's a gift to them. And you're not getting anything back, see? I mean, you're going to write this poem, and it might get published in Poetry Magazine. You know, and that edition of Poetry Magazine will be printed, and then it goes into people's recycling, you know? Yeah. But, you know, somebody might love that poem. It might change their life. You know, and all that is the fate of all the gifts that humans give. They all get put into recycling. You know, I mean, it's true. There's the Mona Lisa, the Pietà. Yes, that's true. But you know, someday those will be forgotten too, if humans exist long enough. You know, because the Pietas just keep piling up. See, the Mona Lisas, they just keep. We keep at, it's like Chinese poetry. There's, you know, if you study Chinese poetry, there's so many poets, there are so many volumes, right? It's like hardly anybody knows it all because it's just so vast, you know. So at some point you say Li Bai, and someday people are going to go, who's Li Bai? Someday people, you can say Shakespeare, people say, who's Shakespeare? You know, who's that guy? It's going to happen. So you know, the best strategy is not to try to be special, but to try to become one with. And when we do that, our hearts are filled with compassion, right? It's everything you do becomes a gift. See, everything you do becomes a gift. You know, in Tibetan and Chinese Buddhism, if you go into a temple in China or into Tibet, you'll see a figure. Sometimes it's a Guanyin represented with 1,000 arms, 1,000 helping hands. And sometimes, you know, it's a little bit strange to see this figure with like 1,000 arms. And each arm is holding like a pen, you know, something to help other people, see? But if we live that way, if we're not trying to be special, we're not trying to have power, but we're trying to help others, it's such a beautiful path, right? So beautiful. It's all here and gone. Impermanence was, as the Buddha said, you know, it's the fate of all things is to come and go. But while we're here, we can live beautifully. If we let go of the desire to control and to be special, and we live our life as a gift to others. You know, so this is what Tolkasan experiences. You know, he's in his small mind, And then he breaks through into his big mind. And now it's not so important to be special. It's not so important to be, you know, powerful. And he actually takes all of his learned commentaries and he burns them, you know. So he's different. He's liberated himself from that illusion. So anyway, after this has happened, the old man, Ryotan, they have like a teisho the next day, or a convocation of all the monks. The next day, Ryotan ascended the rostrum and said, you know, there's among you, you monks, there's a guy sitting over there, and his fangs are like a sword tree. His mouth is like a bowl of blood. If you hit him with a stick, he's in such deep samadhi, he won't even turn his head to look at you. Someday, he's going to help a lot of people because he's liberated from this craving for specialness. And Tokusan took his notes to the Dhamma Sutra, to the front of the hall, and he set them on fire. And he said, even though you have exhausted, you can study, you know, there's 108 volumes in the Tibetan collection of sutras. And the Chinese collection of sutras is even bigger, you know. You can read it all. There are sutras you've never even heard of. Nobody I know has read all the sutras. There's just like, there's so many sutras, it's unbelievable. You know, if you read just the Mahayana sutras, your life is probably not long enough, you know. So he says, even though you have exhausted the abstruse doctrines, all of that knowledge is like a hair of your head in vast space. It's like a drop of water in an ocean. See, becoming one with the ocean. Be a drop in the ocean. Live in the vast space of the big mind. And he burned all his notes. Mumon's comment, hearing the name cannot surpass the face. Seeing the face cannot surpass hearing the name. He may have saved his nose, but alas, he lost his eyes. So, in other words, that's Mumon's way of saying that he woke up.